Hello, everybody out there in podcast land, and welcome to the Front Row Flashbacks, a part of the Front Row Network and NPR Illinois Community Voices. I am Ryan Lutens, diehard horror fanboy and all-around Academy Awards snob.
I'm Jay Hoffman, master of the dad joke and interpretive dance.
And I'm Erin McCabe, the peace bringer and insightful mama hen of the show.
Here on Flashbacks, we like to get all nostalgia-like about the movies of our past. Movies from the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s that have shaped the way we look at cinema and pop culture today, and how those movies have given us insight and hope in our everyday lives.
So strap on your fanny packs.
Hold on to your butts.
And let's get ready to flashback.
If you've ever been on a road trip with your gal pals that takes a sudden turn to Shitsville, turning you and your bestie into Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid's female counterparts, then you might be thinking about Thelma and Louise. Well, we're here talking about, I don't even know how to categorize this movie, Thelma and Louise. There's a bunch of different ways you can, but I'm excited to do it. And I'm here with Jay. Jay, how are you today?
I'm doing well. Talking about Shitsville. My kid did that in the tub right before we started, so pretty good. Pretty good day.
Parents, man. My kid threw up in the tub like 2 days ago on Valentine, or a couple days ago on Valentine's Day, and my husband had to clean it up. He was not happy. Strawberry chunks everywhere. Just the worst.
Oh, yeah. Kids are great. Fun. Everyone should have some.
Have kids, they said. It'd be fun, they said. Oh. Well, usually Ryan's with us tonight. He's taking a little break from flashbacks. He'll be back in time for Oscar season. So we miss you, Ryan. If you are tuning in to listen to us, we are talking about a very, very very, very female empowerment movie, which is right up Ryan's alley. So we're sad he can't be joining us for it.
He's the most feminist I've ever met.
So true. So I'm kind of sad that he's not here to talk about it with us, but that's okay.
You know, you didn't know quite how to classify it. I call it outlaw road trip movie.
Yeah. That's a good, yeah.
There's a lot going on.
There is a lot going on. Why don't you give us the rundown of this
movie? All right. Two besties plan a weekend trip for the mountains, chock full of camping fun to escape the toxic men in their lives. Thelma, the passive housewife, and Louise, the hyper-confident waitress, head out on a weekend of fun. On night one of this getaway, a man goes from charming to rapey in a nanosecond. Louise shoots him on the spot, putting a vengeful grin on my wife's face. That's true. She smiled really big when that happened.
Oh, man.
Then the two escape, and thus two highly empowered outlaws are born. Along the way, we meet a who's who of Quentin Tarantino favorites, Brad Pitt, Michael Madsen, and Harvey Keitel, as they all create roadblocks to stop or circumvent our antiheroes from escaping to Mexico. Because we know from all 90s movies that Mexico and the U.S. clearly had no extradition laws. Instead of getting captured and imprisoned, these ladies cast off into the Grand Canyon.
So, do you think that even before we start the fun facts, Mexico and the United States had an extradition agreement, what, 1978? Is that what you showed? Yes. I love how you did a background check on that.
I looked it up because I was like, God, there's so many movies where everybody's trying to run to Mexico.
Constantly.
And I don't know why, because they're just going to get caught and sent back. Maybe it's like, well, we can hide in Mexico and we won't get caught. But there's definitely extradition laws. And maybe it's because we live in a Snowden world.
And, right.
You know, that
there's
dude
no
had
hiding
to go to,
now.
that dude had to go to Russia, so he didn't get extradited.
Right.
So maybe that's just like too much in our knowledge now versus then, but it just, I don't know. It just seemed really weird to me. So I was like, did we have extradition laws? And sure as shit, we do.
Well, and the information is like so available now, right? Like how many people saw that? And so maybe they didn't know. Maybe they were all really running to Mexico. And then it was kind of like, I kept picturing that scene from The Simpsons where Homer's got this, like, he's got the, like, the snow machine, the, like, recording machine, and, like, it's got wheels, and it wheels out of the house, and he goes, oh, no, you don't, and he pulls it back, like, into the house and breaks the legs off. Like, that's what it reminded me of, like, all these people going to Mexico being, like, suckers, and then Mexico being, like, oh, no, right back to the United States you go.
Well, and to find that out, I mean, you'd have to like go to the library and figure out what law book it was in.
Oh my gosh, yeah, right.
And ugh, can't believe we lived during that.
Oh, I know, right? You had to get into the Dewey Decimal System to find those papers.
Back when we didn't care, it wasn't even worth finding something out.
So true, so
true.
Such
a pain in the butt.
But you did also have a much greater chance of getting away to a foreign country and changing your name and changing your identity and kind of slipping away and being able to not be found. Like, that's, you know, now it's like, true. Oh my gosh, you know.
Yeah, you'd immediately pop up on a Facebook algorithm.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Well, I think like my father-in-law is very anti, you know, social media. I'm like, bro, Facebook already has a profile on you and you don't have a Facebook.
You don't even know it.
They already have a profile on you.
I mean, technically you kind of like couldn't even have a phone. And then, so it's kind of funny, you know, we're not going to get into it, but I remember there was a meme where it was like, people saying they don't want the vaccine because it's going to put a tracking chip in it. And it's like their phone's in their back pocket. And it's the Leonardo DiCaprio face from Django Unchained. Like,
yeah. So yeah. True. That's where the chip's going to go.
Right. Exactly. It's like, yo, your phone's already doing it. So let's get into some of the facts here.
What kind of facts are they?
Fun facts. And they are fun, a little more fun than some of the other movies. But hey, were you surprised to find out that this director was Ridley Scott? This is a Ridley Scott film.
Yeah, I don't think I don't know if I knew that.
I didn't. I definitely
I don't think
didn't.
I did.
And it kind of blew my mind. It blew my mind open a little bit. We'll get into that later. But this movie, Thelma & Louise, is directed by Ridley Scott. It's written by Callie Khoury. It stars an awesome, awesome cast. We've got Susan Sarandon playing Louise. We've got Gina Davis playing Thelma. Harvey Keitel playing Hal. Michael Madsen is Jimmy. Christopher McDonald is Daryl. Stephen Tobolowsky as Max. And Brad Pitt is JD. Now, I knew, Jay, after how you reacted all about James Spader and Pretty in Pink, that you were going to enjoy you some Brad Pitt in this movie.
Let me say this. He's like a pipsqueak in this movie.
He kind of is.
He can't weigh more than 140 pounds.
I know. It's so true.
He's like all skin and bones.
Yeah.
He needs to eat something.
He's like a little baby in this movie. Baby Brad Pitt. The budget of this film was an estimated $16.5 million, and opening weekend in the U.S., it grossed $6.1 million. Overall in the United States, it grossed a total of $45.3 million, and cumulatively worldwide, $45.5 million. So it didn't really do much better in the international market than it did domestically.
Yeah, and I wanted to say something on that, and I think this feels like a very American movie.
Yes.
It's the road trip.
Yes.
You're getting America, all the scenery of, you know, Oklahoma and Arizona, and you get some of the national parks, and it feels like a very American movie. It's outlaw stuff. It's
right.
Country Western music throughout. So
yeah.
I don't know if I was surprised that it didn't have quite that market. outside.
I wasn't at all for this. I think you hit the nail on the head with exactly who it was targeted for, and it didn't reach beyond that. This score on Rotten or this movie on Rotten Tomatoes has an 84% rating and an audience score of 82%. So it's always refreshing to see when the critic and the audience score matches up. This movie was nominated for several awards. Academy Award nominations for Best Actress in a Leading Role, Gina Davis and Susan Sarandon. For Best Director, Best Cinematography, and Best Film Editing. It was a winner in the Academy Awards for Best Original Screenplay for Callie Khouri and a Golden Globe winner for the same category. It received countless other nominations. And so, Jay, you were asking about this on the thread, and you had brought this up, that this is the fifth, and as of 2020, the most recent film to receive two Best Actress Oscar nominations, with both Susan Sarandon and Gina Davis both being nominated in the same category in the same year, which I've never seen that. I mean, obviously it happens, but I didn't know that you could have two characters in a film both go for the leading role. It's obviously very rare, as you've pointed out.
Yeah. Well, and this is the last movie for best actor or best actress. This was the last one. There's quite a few more dual best actor nominations from the same movie. Like I said, there's only five with the best actress. It doesn't shock me. Seems like there's just not as many. Seems like all of cinema is kind of geared toward the leading man roles. So it doesn't surprise
me. I feel like it's this movie really does have both of those characters getting the same amount of screen time. Their roles are just as impactful, where usually it is really geared towards one or the other instead of both.
Yeah, well, and now our chat's been too with movies like The Five Bloods, which is really an ensemble movie. I know myself, I'm going nuts over one of the performances in it, and who's getting nominated for lead actor, for supporting actor in that one? When the reality is they got five people that they could probably choose from for lead.
Yeah.
Same thing, Trial of the Chicago 7, probably a few people they could pick for lead. But it seems like, and Lou Hare from Guilty Pleasures pointed this out, studios are a little more strategic in who they're putting to those.
Interesting.
To try to increase their chances of winning, which then falls into why I have issues all around with the Oscars. Like, is it about the art and the impact? And,
right.
Or is it just about trying to litter your film with awards so that it gets more views, which is more of a business thing. And that kind of takes away from the awards for me.
Yeah, I agree with that. It makes it feel not as authentic.
Hollywood, not authentic?
Say it ain't so. So they lost. Gina Davis and Susan Sarandon both lost to Jodie Foster for her role in Silence of the Lambs that year in 1991. Strong year for female leads, man. Other films with two actresses nominated for Best Actress are All About Eve in 1950, Suddenly Last Summer in 1959, The Turning Point in 1977, and Terms of Endearment for 1983. So if you want to talk those, you're going to have to go over to Classics and talk to Brandon and Eric. Before Brad Pitt was cast in the role, it went to William Baldwin, but he ended up dropping out. And so there's an interesting little sidebar with that too. Brad Pitt, the role went to Billy Baldwin, but he ended up dropping out. And so there's this kind of funny, like, circular thing that happened. I guess Brad Pitt was auditioning for the role in Backdraft, but they gave it to Billy Baldwin, which is why Billy Baldwin dropped out of Thelma and Louise. And then Brad Pitt got that role in Thelma and Louise.
Brad Pitt, where William Baldwin's getting roles over him.
Who's laughing now, Billy? George Clooney was rejected multiple times. That kind of cracks me up too. Like, how desperate was he to get in Thelma and Louise that he was rejected multiple times?
91? I mean, what was on his acting credit at that point? Roseanne was, I don't
probably
did he have anything bigger than Roseanne at that time. I mean,
and then in 94, he gets into ER.
Yeah, he wasn't on ER yet, so nobody had a Caesar haircut until 1994.
Yeah, exactly.
And every barber only learned how to do the Caesar haircut. We looked like dorks in the 90s.
Oh, man. Don't get me started.
No offense to our crowd who still gets the Caesar haircut. You all look very, very
you guys look great.
Imperialistic.
At least you didn't. At least you didn't pluck all your eyebrows off in the 90s like us girls did. Whew, that was rough. Mark Ruffalo auditioned for this role too. This role was a hot commodity.
I mean, this is Brad Pitt's breakout role.
Yeah, I mean, really. And then eventually, this is cracking me up too, because we got a little, we're throwing it back to our Pretty in Pink, which the same thing kind of happened. Apparently, Robert Downey Jr. landed the role, but then Ridley deemed him too short compared to Gina Davis, and she was the one who picked Brad Pitt to do the part. So Robert Downey Jr. not only got he got knocked out of the role of Ducky by Molly Ringwald in 1985's Pretty in Pink, he also got knocked out of Thelma and Louise by Gina Davis.
Well, to be fair, she's like 6'3", and I think he's like my she's very, very tall.
Yeah.
And I think he's like, I think he's like my size. I think we're little guys and we're used to it.
Michelle Pfeiffer and Jodie Foster were originally chosen for the leads and accepted the roles, but pre-production took too long and they had a dropout due to other commitments. That would have been an interesting movie.
That would have been a totally different movie, except Jodie Foster would have had the same accent that she had in Silence of the Lambs.
That's accurate.
But with less depression attached to the voice, I think.
Also accurate. In 2016, the United States Library of Congress selected the film for preservation in the National Film Registry, finding it culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant. And I would agree.
Yeah.
What about you?
I agree. I like it. I like it.
So let's get into it. What's your first memory of Thelma and Louise?
I think my first memory, more than the movie, are clips from the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. One, it's not really an appropriate movie for you know, I was 5 when it came out, so not too appropriate for a 5-year-old. But I mean, this is one of those, you know, we're always talking TNT, TBS. This is another one of those movies that would be on it. But I think I remember scenes, the end scene. You know, but I think scenes from this movie, I told you I was really glad you picked this movie, because this movie was in the pop culture zeitgeist for like a long time, and then it just wasn't. Like, it seems like it isn't.
It was like relevant forever, and then one day it just was not.
Yeah, like everybody would get a reference to Thelma and Louise, and I don't think people would now. And that weirds me out. I don't know what like what happened. Feels like, and maybe I'm just out of touch. I don't know. But first time I watched it. I mean, I think was when I bought it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, 10 years ago, where I actually watched the whole thing. And I really liked it. I don't think I knew what the movie was when I watched it. Like, I think I was just like, it's a road trip movie.
Right.
Then like, you know, you're like 25 minutes in, you're like, oh, this got dark.
Yeah.
This is that dark.
You're like, everything seems so fun. We're oh shit. Dancing.
Is that a wild country? I used to hang out in a wild country in Texas.
Right. The best. My God.
Oh God.
Yeah. Everything went wrong and then it just keeps getting worse. No, for sure.
But yet it's still like fun and upbeat. The tone of this movie is very, it's different.
How so?
I think it's interesting that they, you know, it's a, it's a failed rape scene, thankfully, but like even getting there, like it's graphic, it's rough, you know, and they show a lot.
Seems and like I was that like, makes
I don't
super
remember any of this. I don't remember. Wow.
Yeah.
But yet, like, it still seems like a positive movie, you know, and upbeat. They rob a gas station. Still seems upbeat. They kill a man. That same man who I think we all agree we're pretty okay with. Still seems upbeat. So I think the tone of this movie is very unique to the times. We can get into this later, but I just watched Promising Young Woman, which I really thought was going to be like a spiritual sequel to Thelma and Louise. And I don't think that now that I've watched it, it's much darker. It gets much more into the psychology, gets much more into like the root cause analysis behind some of these issues and why it's a lot of he said, she said stories. Is it around our culture of drinking? You know, is there something that's been perpetuated with the culture of drinking, which is really not just because of COVID is starting to disappear. People aren't drinking like they used to. So it gets dark and it gets darker and it never really feels upbeat or empowering. I think it feels more, I don't know what the word is. Depressing is not the word, just like consuming, right? Feels like the issues that it's about and this movie's about, that the new movie feels like she's completely consumed by it, which
like
is probably
she never kind of gets out from underneath the impact of what's happened to her.
Yeah, well, and it's really what happened. Well, I don't want to say. So, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, whereas these girls take those things and it becomes an empowering thing, which I think is a fun thing to watch, which one's probably the more realistic.
Do you feel like in Thelma and Louise, there's more of a liberation of the women in their experience?
And I wonder too if it's because they have someone to lean on, you know
I think it's probably, I don't know, I only speak for myself and no one else. I think there are certain, I can relate to several different scenarios that take place in this movie in which, as a woman, you're put in situations you'd rather not be in with men. And I think that there's a way you can look at a movie like this and take those experiences, and you can potentially, and again, this is just me. This is not anyone else's experience, just my own. Could take those experiences and those things that happen and those, I don't know, you could take it and you could look at it as, even in looking at this movie, like, look how terrible all these men are, right? And all these things that happened and how awful they are, and kind of let that eat you up and then see the world through that lens. And I think there also comes a point which you can make, choices to start to try to get out from under some of those things or see things and choose to look at it in a different lens. And we can get into that later, but, I want to be delicate with that, because obviously, like, these are heavy things and everyone has had different experiences. So, like, I've had some of these kind of same experiences, not to the extreme. But like, I don't feel like I'm like weighed down underneath them. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I also didn't drive off a cliff, but I feel like by allowing myself like the mental freedom and working through that, it did liberate me, so that like, I'm not a prisoner of my own mind, of things of my own past, And I kind of made a conscious choice to move towards that, realizing that I may be a prisoner in my own mind for my life. If I didn't, you know what I mean? Where this movie kind of really dives into also, there's a lot of ways socially and culturally in the time in which this movie takes place that like women were in, like, it wasn't just like a mental or a psychological bondage, but like there were things that were very obstructive to leading a liberating and free kind of existence. And there's some gut punch quotes from Susan Sarandon throughout this movie that kind of remind you of that.
Yeah. And if anybody doesn't know what Aaron's talking about, just watch any movie from this era. Really, I just watched A Few Good Men the other night, right? Like Aaron Sorkin, great. Jack Nicholson talks about Tom Cruise getting a blowjob from Demi Moore as his commanding officer to them as a colonel. I was like, whoa, what the hell? Now,
yeah.
So it plays into the movie a little differently. You know, it's him kind of getting a psychological edge, but like you couldn't even try to get his psychological edge. Like, oh, you're screwed. Like, what the hell is that, dude? Wait, you can't talk to people like that. And like movies are littered with that stuff. You can, you know, flashbacks. That's what we do. So there's so many times I'm watching a movie, I'm like, oh, you can't talk to people like that anymore. What are you doing?
Right. And like when we're talking about, you know, thought, like, so I saw this movie in its entirety like years ago, and then I rewatched it. And even through that, like, you know, just as your life has changed and maybe you've gone through your own things or like healed some of your own wounds or looked and saw things through new perspectives or other things have happened in the world that have offered you new perspectives as well. Like you just see it in a different lens. So like, you know, when we're watching these movies back from the past or in the 90s or whatever, like, you know, it's reflective of the culture of like, that is a lot of the way, like how I just resonate so much with how just not even the men being completely malicious, but some of them just being like ignorantly gross. And like even and then like there is some definite like intentionally gross. Like when I was and this is 1992, when I was 10 years old, I was with my friend's parents. I was spending the day with my friend, my neighbor who lived up the block. We were in a builder square and we were all just kind of like wandering around. Like, of course, you kind of like wander by yourself because it's 1992 and you're 10. And like a 50 or 60 year old man started grabbing my butt in the aisle by myself. And I like had to run away and he was like following me. And that was like acceptable stuff. And I never told anybody.
Sorry. I'm like, I got to realize they can't see the face I'm making. Yeah.
But like they, and I have multiple, right. Like that, like things like that would happen. Like some 60-year-old guy just thought it was okay to grab a 10-year-old girl in the middle of an aisle of it was like a Home Depot.
That's Jesus Christ.
Like things like that. I mean, I could list off a whole lot of other things. Like I could list off a whole lot of other things, but, you know, like that kind of stuff was acceptable. You know, and you don't hear about that as much. And I think people have, and society has grown quite a bit and women's, but like in this movie, there's several points in which you just get a flavor for, I don't know. I'm not saying that like everything was terrible to be a woman in the 90s, but like, I think looking back, you can see really how far things have come in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's why like art like this is important.
Yeah.
I think one is to get like the voice you're talking about out. It's also like, so like dopey doofuses like me, I'm like, oh, that's inappropriate. You know, like, like, oh, I see now, you know, like,
right.
And maybe it'll hit some of those dudes that are, you know, not the extreme ends of things like happen in this movie. Like there's like a guy who's legit trying to rape someone in a parking lot. I'm not talking about that. Just like saying dirty things and saying stupid shit that they're not supposed, you know, maybe seeing this stuff too and more, seeing it more frequently helps on that. And, you know, we're always talking about diversity and all that stuff in movies. That's why, that's what it does. It shows that side of things. But when this movie came out, while it has mostly positive reviews, most of the negative reviews were it's man bashing.
Yeah, I saw that.
There's
too.
A lot of that. One thing I'll say, there is only one guy in this movie who is honorable.
Yeah.
And it's Hal.
I know. Hal was great.
Harvey Keitel is the he's doing everything he can to protect Thelma and Louise. There's a part where he shows up at a scene and a crime scene, and some girls, you know, that he knows, but she's making moves and kind of catcalling, and he's like, ah, calm down, you know. He kind of bats her away, but very gentlemanly. Like the whole movie, he's nothing but a gentleman. And
yeah, he really is.
All the other guys are kind of trash.
Like, if I'm really honest, I kind of want a show, or I want a show, or at least a limited series of a police team of Hal from Thelma and Louise, and why am I blanking on her name? Frances McDormand's character from Fargo. I want them together as a police team, and I want that show, and I want it now. And I don't think it's too much to ask.
No. How old is Harvey Keitel?
Yes.
He's pretty old dude now. I don't know.
Margie. I want Margie and Hal.
Margie and
Hal. I want Margie and Hal.
That's what it'd be called too.
Yes.
Margie and Hal.
They'd be the best. The best. I read that about this being the big criticism. And I look at it two ways. Okay. I think you can look at it through the lens of like, there's a way to look at it and see the movie and go like, yeah, all men are pigs and they're all gross and they're all this and they're all that. I mean, and again, I can get into the examples of all the ways that this movie, I've had this stuff happen to me. But I think if you look at it that way, like, yeah, I mean, but then you as an audience member are choosing to bash men. You can also look at it and say, you know, we're putting on display all of the ways that chauvinism and misogyny has played out in relationships and male-female dynamics, you know, in this period of time. And it's worth shining a spotlight on because these things happen and these relationships are real, but we don't think that they, you know, we don't think that they represent all men, but these are some of the not good ones.
Yeah. There was each character, each male character represented kind of a type.
Yeah.
Right. You had Thelma's husband, Daryl, played by Christopher McDonald.
Just the
5 years later, he would go on to lose a very important golf match to Happy Gilmore. He, you know, just kind of the domineering husband, does what he wants, you know, controlling.
Michael Madsen was insufferable.
He's just, nobody liked him. That was
nobody liked him.
The cops took over his house. That part didn't really make much sense to me.
They're all watching a movie.
Yeah, they took over his house to wait for a call from Thelma and Louise, and they just took over his TV and everything. And they just like put him in his place. You had Michael Madsen as Jimmy, who was sweet on the surface, but he was another one who's controlling. Brad Pitt really was like a nice
controlling.
I do. I think it was. It was so Jimmy's like the clear cut in your face. Or excuse me, not Daryl. Daryl is.
He threw some things.
And Luis, he threw Luis into a door when she was trying to get out.
Wow, I blocked some of that out of my memory, and I'm not going to tell you that that's also... I've also been in relationships where that's happened, so that's maybe not... maybe I got some work to do.
I'm here for you, sister.
Oh, you're the best.
You got JD, who really is sweet, but, you know, he uses his sweetness and his charm to take advantage of people.
Yeah, clearly he's not a good influence, and right, he screwed them over. Figuring
literally and
yeah,
literally.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a pretty steamy sex scene.
It was steamy.
And then you got Hal, right? Who's kind of the honorable guy. So I think they were trying to show, like, hey, here's this kind of smattering of types.
Right. And along the way, obviously you run into the terrible guy at the bar. Just awful from the moment he walks up. You can feel it in your pit. Luis knows he's a bad guy. Even though, you know, you find out in the film of why she kind of has a chip on her shoulder about men in general, but like, he's just the waitress thinks he's a jerk. She's like, leave these girls alone. Like, and there's one of those in every bar. Not always to that extreme, but just a dude that won't leave the girls alone and doesn't know when no means no, or enough is enough. And then even the trucker. Okay, like, here's what I'm going to say about the trucker, that genre of dude. He still exists, okay? The trucker still, instead of a trucker, like, you know, pulling up next to you honking, like, it's a dick pic on your phone or it's someone sliding into your DMs. Like, that dude's still out there. He's all over. So, he's alive and well.
Yeah, what a weird thing to send to people.
It's never happened to me, but I know people it has. It's never happened to me. I send a very strong, I think I send a very strong, like, no pics vibe. I must.
Anyways, let's get into the acting.
I thought we were into the acting.
We were into the types, but like, yeah, the actual performances. I think, you know, we got to start with the leads, Susan Sarandon as Louise and Gina Davis as Thelma. What are your thoughts?
Well, let me ask you, who was your fave?
Louise.
Yeah, me too.
Thelma's a little too naive for me.
Thelma and, man, Gina, I mean, these two actresses are just stunning. They're beautiful. They're smart. They play their roles so well. They play those characters to the nines, but yeah, Thelma is like a bad combination of naivete and needing, not realizing she's outsourcing all of her self-worth to all of the men around her or the people around her, really, until the very end. You know, she and with that, then making some not great decisions along the way that kind of gets them deeper into trouble as the movie goes on. And Louise, you know, you can really tell the maturity between the two. Like, I think that the movie does that really well with both of them. Like, they're actually 10 years apart in age, in real life, but I feel like it felt like a 10 year difference, in the movie as well. What do you think?
No, I agree. Thelma's definitely her younger friend. They get along, and like, Luis is definitely pissed off at Thelma more than the inverse.
Oh yeah.
In that relationship, you know, she wants to be the rock that empowers her to do things, is what I think. And she's constantly trying to teach her those lessons. But yeah, I think the problem Thelma had is, like, once they went on their trip, it was like, she got taken out of the cave, and then once everything went wrong, like, her whole worldview was just in chaos.
Yeah.
And she was like grasping it at anything and everything.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
What do you think about, I thought one thing I'll say about the performance is I thought Gina Davis's accent was a little heavy-handed. But I think I this is
see that.
I think this is a 90s thing. I had the same thing.
That's true. Fargo.
It just seemed a little heavy-handed on the
Yeah, I'm trying to think of, I mean, I hate to say this, but it's like I'm like comparing it to Tremors. But like the same, like kind of like Kevin Bacon's, like they both have kind of a heavy accent. It's like, you know, the like and I'm trying to think of other movies that take place in that area. Yeah. Even like even Aaron Brockovich. Like it is. I think it's a time frame thing where the accents were just like kind of real thick.
That was kind of the only issue I had. But what I'll say about Gina Davis, you know, you mentioned how pretty both of them are, but her and Leah Thompson, those are like the two ladies, like little kid me who's like crushing hard on.
Oh yeah, I could see that. I think those are excellent choices. Gina Davis is like
everything in the 90s too.
I know, really, so true. And Susan Sarandon is just gorgeous. And her accent, I don't know where she's from, but it does just seem like it's just more natural and it just comes easy to her. And I don't know if that's because she's got a natural kind of draw a little bit.
Well, and I think Christopher McDonald was the same as Daryl. I think he was a little heavy. He was the only other one I really noticed.
Okay.
Him,
I thought
him
he played that role really well, though.
I liked him a lot. I thought he was good. And this is the only time I would ever
be
like... He did
such a good job that I didn't like him. That's how I know it was good.
Never... You know, we're talking about Brad Pitt's breakout role, and I was making jokes about his sexy abs, but he's a pipsqueak. This is the only time I would ever say that Shooter McGavin would beat up Brad Pitt in this movie. If he'd have got his hands on him, he would have beat him up because he is twice the size of Brad Pitt in this movie. I can't believe how small... Like, seriously, he like if I sneezed, I feel like Brad Pitt would blow away in this movie.
Oh, my God.
Not to body shame him. It's just you're used to, like, Brad Pitt from Troy, where he's just
that's
like
what I was thinking.
A freaking Adonis.
Oh, my God. Totally. Nope. You're not wrong. You're not wrong. But, yeah, I'm trying. Like, I love the girl's performance is so good. It's interesting. I feel like Luis really is you don't see a huge evolution in her character like you do with Thelma. Thelma goes from super giddy, kind of ditzy, like you said, like it was like, it's like you released a domesticated animal into the wild. And then by the end, she really kind of comes into her own. Where she just like, and they do that really well visually too. She's very, you know, she's got the cute little white dress or crop top with the skirt and her hair's all done and her makeup's all perfect. And by the end, she's like, got like a ripped t-shirt and jeans on. She's smoking cigarettes. She's drinking Wild Turkey and like her hair's all over the place. And she's like, whatever, shooting guns. You know, she really... She really, yeah, comes into it, I think. I'm trying to think of any other roles that really stood out. I mean, they keep the cast pretty focused.
Yeah. Well, and like Harvey Keitel, that seems like he had a lot of roles similar. Like,
yeah,
Hal very well could be the wolf from Pulp Fiction, very well could be, you know, just slight differences. Michael Madsen's Jimmy.
Oh my gosh. He really is he's like cookie cutter. Just throw him in a movie and he's that guy.
Yeah. Here's who stood out to me. Stephen Tobolowsky. Stephen Tobolowsky almost always plays a nerd. He's Needle Nose Ned, Ned the Head, Ned Ryerson from Groundhog's Day.
Mm.
He's the principal in the Goldbergs for a good chunk of it.
Oh my God. I love the Goldbergs.
He always plays kind of a neurotic guy, a Silicon Valley neurotic guy. But in this one, like, he's just like a kind of procedural FBI dick. Like, he's just a jerk.
Yeah.
And it stands out to me just because he's been, I'll say, pigeonholed a little bit. I think he does the role so well. I mean, how many times a day do you think people walk by that guy and go, Needle Nose Ned, Ned the Head, Ned Ryers? Like, that movie's from, you know.
Right.
That movie's 30 years old. And he's hardly in the movie, you know. And
yeah, he doesn't have a lot of lines.
He's basically played a version of that character for his whole career, which hey, that's awesome, you know, getting paid, doing what you do well. But I think this showed me like, oh, he's not just that. Like I was like, oh, he's like a serious dude. You know, I didn't think, hey, that's the guy who's the kind of nerdy guy and everything.
So right.
His stood out. And then I think Brad Pitt stood out just because of his evolution as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
This comes up on the thread, our Front Row Network chat thread fairly frequently, where, you know, he started off as pretty boy that nobody took seriously to, I think, one of the finest actors in Hollywood right now.
Yeah.
But you can kind of, I think he's good in this movie, but, you know, he's not Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Brad Pitt. You know,
no, I mean? Like, I think you hit that nail on the head though. Like pretty boy that no one took seriously, and then look, it ended up biting Thelma in the ass.
Yeah, that he
and Hollywood too. Oh,
Brad Pitt was playing Brad Pitt in this movie.
Totally. But yeah, it's like everyone, you hear this big woo about Brad Pitt in Thelma and Louise, and really it's just because he doesn't have a shirt on, but he doesn't bring a whole lot to the table as far as acting chops in this movie. This is not where he really comes out to be the actor, the artist that he is. He did. It was just like, he got his foot in the door. Well, what about, oh, I'm sorry. That is saying something. Okay. Sorry. I had a little snafu there. What do you think about, like, what are some takeaways for you from this film?
For me, the scenery and the music.
The music?
Oh yeah. Well, first of all, like, I'm a punk rocker through and through, but I also love me some 90s country. So I'm going to take this time and talk shit to Lou Hare, since he's not here to defend himself. When he did his 90s music bracket, he didn't have 90s country.
Oh yeah, you
were. And every time
I
bring it up, he just craps on the idea. So now that he can't defend himself, that was a good time to strike. What I like is, one, the music fits the area. They start in Arkansas, work through Oklahoma, they avoid Texas because of Luis's past, then into Arizona. So they kind of get that Southwest vibe. So you get that country western music, and that man, this movie feels 90s because of that music.
Yes.
There's also a square dance scene,
yes,
which I looked at my wife, I'm like, oh my god, do you remember that? Like, in the early 90s, like, every town square and park had square dancing lessons going on. Now you're from the big city.
Yeah, up in Chicago, that was not what was going on.
I don't know if you're aware of this. Chicago is like the country, you know, that's where the most country records are sold, is Chicago, Illinois.
So, really?
Yeah, really.
Whoa.
So you don't know what you're talking about.
You were, well,
five. I grew up in a small,
you were five in 1991. You were not doing line dancing, were you?
I wasn't. No.
Okay.
I have an older sister and a mother who definitely were.
That's hilarious.
I'm like, I'm going to go to the swing set while you guys are here at the pavilion with these other dorks doing square
dancing.
Oh
my God. I grew up on the south side of Chicago, so there's a lot of Irish people. So the only kind of line dancing was Irish line dancing.
It's probably the same thing.
It's similar. A lot more kicks though, and curly hair.
Yeah. So I don't know, that was like a big thing. At least in small town Illinois,
mm-hmm,
for sure. Was square dancing was huge.
We have some like country, we had country bars up here. Like, I remember even in college, like going to a, you know, it's kind of funny, my college roommate, now that I think about it, like several times, like we'd find a bar like that. One of our friends grew up in, one of our college friends grew up in, I can't remember now what town it was, but like out in the middle of Illinois. And it was like, we're going to a bar like that. Like, we're exactly like the same setup. Everyone's just kind of drinking around, and then there's line dancing, and me being from Chicago, I'm sitting in this bar going, yo, these people are wearing like cowboy boots and hats. And like, is this serious? Like they got those collar things on. They're like, shut up, shut up. You know, like it was like a new, it was very interesting for me to actually like experience because I don't remember like that. I didn't see that growing up.
I don't know if you know what the Midwest is known for, but farming.
I know.
What's every country talking about?
Right.
Farming or ranching. Ranching's where you get the Southwest part of the country and farming's the Midwest part.
Yeah.
Well, and the other part about that is I was stationed in Texas for 2 years and, you know, we had a wild country, which is like a chain of dance clubs. There was one of those right outside of base, same setup and everything.
Oh, cool.
But what I will tell you is everyone in Texas knows how to dance. They all know how to two-step, not line dancing. They know how to two-step. So the creep that was with Gina Davis, like he was a creep, but he knew how to dance.
Mm.
Right. He was doing the two-step and he was just taking her along. And I'm telling you those boys there in Oklahoma and Texas and that region, they know how to do that kind of dancing.
Yeah.
Really well. And I went to this really, this is a fun story, really small town called Pretty, Texas.
Mm.
I think there was like 500 people, but they had this like dance hall and every week it's like filled with people. It was like BYOB and country Western music.
How
and,
fun.
Yeah. It was one of the guys I was stationed with was from there and went on that little adventure. Although I don't think they liked my sense of humor very well.
No.
I don't know why. I think I'm hilarious. But that and the scenery. I thought the scenery, I mean, that was road trip scenery, man. It was just a beautiful movie. And it kind of highlighted some of the beauty of this country, I think.
Oh, hands down. This for sure. I guess I just didn't realize how much the like big sweeping scenery scenes are also very Ridley Scott, you know, like in all. And so when I was watching it, it was making me think back to, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm like, I didn't even realize this was a Ridley Scott movie. And then I'm thinking about all the kind of like scenes in, what are we watching right now that you and I just got done talking about? Why am I blanking on this?
Raised by Wolves.
But like all the like scenery shots, you know, and being like, man, I just didn't realize that's like part of Ridley Scott. And I loved seeing that. So Americana. And even the like, I love road trips. It's like a dream of mine to drive Route 66 all the way to LA. It really is.
It goes right by my house.
I'll stop and say hi. But I do like, I love the like old gas stations and the old route and the stars and like everything and all that natural beauty. And it made me, yeah, like really want to be like, oh, let's get a camper and put the kids in the car and go. Now the soundtrack for me, can you believe this is a Hans Zimmer? This is a Hans Zimmer score. Because it doesn't sound like one. You've got like the 90s.
Don't pigeonhole the man.
Well, it's just funny because like when you think Hans Zimmer, it's not this film. Yeah, oh, obviously yeah. You got to start somewhere. But it's like, wow. But it does have a lot of the like 90s-esque like guitar riffs, like twangy guitar riffs like in scenes. And then I'd say though the music for me, like, I didn't know, it's not a soundtrack that I would hear a song and go, oh, that reminds me of Thelma and Louise. Like, it wasn't really a soundtrack that, like, stuck with me, you know?
No, I didn't think that about the song. I just thought the songs fit the movie. Not totally. That there was, like, you know, Thelma and Louise doesn't have its, like, Footloose song.
Did have a Kenny Loggins song, though. There was a Kenny Loggins.
Which one?
I have to go back and look exactly what it was, but there's a Kenny Loggins when they first pull up to the truck the first time. Well,
to be fair, every movie from 1980 to 1995 has a Kenny Loggins song.
You got to have one.
It was at least. Every studio had a deal with him.
For sure. But yeah, I loved that. And then you know, obviously for me, some of this stuff hits a little closer to home than for other stuff, you know? So like, just even going back to Thelma or, what's her name's, Luis's lines, like when she's holding up, the creeps, you know, with the gun after she's gotten Thelma away from him. And she gets so, that scene, it like, kills me in my stomach to even think about it. But when she's like, when a girl's crying like that, she's not having any fun. And like, you can hear her own voice cracking. Like, that was just super impactful to me. And just some of those other, you know, she makes another line where I think when Thelma is going, we need to just go, we need to go to the police, we just to tell them what happened and it'll all be fine. And she's like, we can't do that. We don't live in that kind of world. Like, no one's going to believe us. That's not the world we live in, I think is what she says. It was just like such a gut punch to hear these things.
Especially when like, now we're coming to, you know, it's all coming to a head. The, the claimer, I guess we'll call him, the victim. And I've had this talk with you too. And I think there's an interesting juxtaposition in all of this. And it's, we live in a world now where we know we need to believe the victim because research shows most of the time they're not lying.
Right.
The only thing that might happen is they might be mistaken on, you know, details, but they're not lying that something happened. Mm-hmm. Right? And it's, so it's trying to justify believing them and tying that with also innocent until proven guilty.
Right.
Right? And these are like two very polar opposite concepts. And one of, you know, we're so firm in our belief in innocent until proven guilty that forever and ever, you know, it was a victim blaming attitude because it's like, well, that person hasn't been convicted. So now you're just throwing accusations. And really mm-hmm. they're just trying to say, I'm not trying to just accuse this. I'm trying to report a crime. You know, I'm trying to report something that's happened. So
right.
It's I think, it's an interesting juxtaposition that we find ourselves in trying to balance those two concepts, have the belief yet also due process. And it's, I think that's where it gets, I don't want to know, muddy maybe, or difficult to navigate. But it's good, you know, even back 30 years ago, they were pointing that out.
Yeah. I mean, this movie really, I think, is pretty incredible for coming out in 1990, for the things that it's bringing up and the points, you know, that it brought up about. And like I said, I'm not sitting here to be like, life as a woman in the 90s was terrible, but like, you can definitely see, like, there were for sure women, more so back then probably than there are now, even though there are still people in situations like this, you know, like, Thelma, where it's like, you're kind of just kept at home. And you don't have an education, you don't have any job experience, you couldn't really go out and like be self-sustaining. So then you're relying on this person who treats you like garbage, in a life you're not happy with not a whole lot of opportunity to free yourself and kind of go on your own path. Which is why, you know, the minute she got out of the house, she wanted to kind of go, you know, she was like ready to just kind of dive into everything head first, the drinking, the dancing, the this, the that, and really didn't have any situational awareness, you know, or anything like that for some of the dangers that could be out there too. And then on top of it, she was sitting in a relationship with somebody who treats her poorly, and probably also told her things about herself, you know, that caused her to have lower self-worth, which then also puts you in a spot where you're more vulnerable to those that may take advantage of you, which we kind of see through the whole film, you know, with Thelma. Mm-hmm. And then on top of it, just this movie does a great job of showing, oh, there is one other nice, cute guy in the movie. The manager of the restaurant, who's like, Thelma, when are you going to run away with me and marry? Like, he's genuinely excited that she's on the phone. He's got a big old smile on his face and he's like genuinely being sweet. So I got to give props to that guy. But like, you know, I think it just did a really good job of showing some of the obstacles women had to really being able to carve and pave their own way through situations, or even just not even that, like just trying to go on vacation, right? Like the trucker is a perfect example. Like you're just trying to do whatever. And like, here comes someone inserting their, you know, sexual needs into your stratosphere without you really inviting it. Like, and I, like when I was 14, I was like, or yeah, 14, 15, like in a car with some friends driving, like pulled up at a stoplight and like looked over and there's a guy, and I'm just a friendly person. And I'm pretty naive myself. And I'm just trying to be nice and kind. And I look over and it's a guy. And I just was like, you know, I smiled at him like, hey, you know, whatever, just cause I'm smiling at everything all the time. And I was like, hey, you know, like, we made eye contact, smile, and the guy smiled back at me, but kind of in like a, like, oh, like you're also cute and interested. And then all of a sudden his body parts are coming outside of the car. Like they're showing up by the window and his private parts. And I was like, go, like telling my friends to hit the gas. It was just like, I didn't want that. I just saying hi. Like there is
weird,
stuff like,
it's like a weird peacock dance this guy was doing anyways. Like
so weird.
This worked one time.
Like, so weird.
Like, what's
so, like,
the logic to it?
It just, is.
Aside from it being disturbing to you, like what's the logic running through
I have
this
no,
guy's brain?
Exactly. Or like, you know, like you're just trying to be at a bar as a girl, as a woman. And like, I can't tell you the amount of time, I can't tell you the amount of groins I've kicked, like soccer punted, to be like, get away from my friends, get away from me, don't come by us again. Like I've kicked at least three men in the balls to be like, get out of here, cause I'm about to break a beer bottle if you come anywhere near my friends or me. Like, it's happened. I had, like, in my 20s, I liked to make out. And I was making out with a guy. And that was about as far as I'd ever go. Because, like, that's just me. And he was really upset about that and started screaming. He didn't, like, press himself on me, but was, like, screaming and calling me names and, like, this far from my face, where I had to, like, run out of a house at my friend's house at, like, 1 o'clock in the morning in Chicago and, like, take a cab to get away to my friend's house. So it's just kind of some of these, like, weird things that, like, and I got drugged with GHB in college.
I want to throw something out there. From this movie.
Yeah.
When they're at the country western bar, they just like leave
their drinks.
They leave their drinks. They leave their purses. Yep. They leave everything. And I was like, I told my wife, I don't even think a guy nowadays would leave his drink unattended. You know what I mean? Like,
oh my,
I think
right.
Like, I think, like, generally the observation is never leave a drink unattended. Definitely don't leave your money unattended.
Right.
So that really stood out to me. I was like, whoa, you're just leaving your drinks on the table to go dance.
Do you think that's like small town mentality of like when you're in a smaller town and we're talking the 90s?
I didn't gather that was a small town. That was like a huge bar full of people.
No, I know. But meaning like, I mean,
well, please. Sure.
Thelma had never been on a town.
Listen, I'm a VFW guy, you know?
You're not leaving.
You leave your drink out there, you know?
Right, right.
That's fine.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, but like I had, you know, someone poured GHB in my drink, and after one drink, I lost consciousness for 6 hours. But here's what I'm going to say about a lot of these things too. And I think this is where you can look at a movie like this or experiences like mine for me personally. And you could be like, yeah, all men are scum and they're pigs and they're this, that, and the other. And say, you know, it's a man hating movie, but like in a lot of scenarios, like let's say the GHB scenario, my guy friends overheard someone talking that they were something about GHB, found me unconscious, and for my safety, moved me to a room, locked the door, and had someone sit outside and then check on me every 30 minutes, you know, to make sure I was okay. Now, what they really should have done was called, you know, I should have gone to the hospital, but it was men who protected me. You know what I mean? And I've had really great men in my life who've also, I forgot when I worked at the country club, I had a member sexually harass me, and it was the golf pros who came and said, that guy will no longer golf here. You know, so like I've had really awesome men in my life who have come to my defense and protection as well. So I guess when I look at a movie like this, I'm not all like, yeah, they're all jerks. But there's some idiots out there. And there's some mean people. So I don't know. This movie was just something for me. Reminded me about all that stuff that I don't worry about too much anymore.
Yeah.
Which is refreshing.
I'll put that in the show notes. This movie is something.
Anything else for impacts for you or?
The only thing I'll say about impact, like I mentioned, is I think this is kind of the feminist, you know, female empowerment, the thing.
Ryan, where are you?
More often than not, we're just for everybody, go listen to our craft episode. And that's why we always make jokes about female empowerment, because me and Ryan get into a debate about it while Aaron's like eating popcorn and listening to this explain how female empowerment works. But you know, I think this really truly is kind of the female empowerment movie for the last, you know, 30 years. And I really think Promising Young Woman is the one we're going to be talking about for the next 30. I really do think a totally different approach, totally different tone. It's not a road trip outlaw movie. The new movie, Promising Young Woman, could never have been made in 1991.
Mm.
Not a chance in hell.
Yeah.
If they thought Thelma and Louise was a man-hating movie, they'd die over this one.
Yeah.
But it's just kind of a similar approach. Look at all the scope of things, but I digress. I think it's got a lot of iconic scenes. I think the ending is one that has been parodied over and over again, you know.
Oh yeah, Woman's
World and you know, about 850 other things where they ramp off into the Grand Canyon. So I think this movie, it's worth a revisit. I messaged you earlier and I said I'm glad you picked this, because it's a movie I have. It's not one I'm like, I'm going to put on Thelma and Louise. It's just not like one of those movies that I think to like throw in, but it's definitely worth throwing in and watching again and enjoying.
I think it's really, I agree. And I think it's really, like you said, it holds up, and it's a movie worth looking at to show and to remember that, like, this was how some things were. It wasn't like hyperbole. Like this movie to me is not hyperbolic, based on my own life experiences, you know, and friends' experiences and whatnot. Like, you know, so it's always good to look at something. And I don't think to live there, but to remember, like, hey, this is where some things were and how some things were done, and let's not go back that way.
Yeah. And I think, like I said, on the flip side, it's important for one, it's just an enjoyable movie, but
yeah,
I think it's important for guys to see this. You know, I had this conversation with my wife, like, it's hard for me to put in perspective sometimes the differences. You know, she's like, yeah, I was walking to my car in the parking lot of Target, and it was a little darker than I wanted. And I saw this, you know, this guy at this vehicle who looked a little shady. And I was like, yeah, okay, so what, did you just go to your car and get in your car? And she's like, well, I was keeping an eye out. Then the guy started kind of walking my, I'm like, holy crap, I wouldn't even have noticed the guy. You know, I wouldn't even have noticed the guy.
Oh,
and I'll
man.
Say,
yeah,
I mean, I'm sure some do. I'm pretty stocky dude, you know? So, mm-hmm. Not too often is somebody coming up to try and,
Well, I live in Chicago and yeah. I work at a very big hospital. And there are crimes around my hospital all yeah. the time. You know, petty crimes, but there are armed robberies. There are armed carjackings. I, you know, not to like drive away tourism in Chicago, but like, let's be realistic.
Yeah. There was a girl. You're the one that's going to turn away the tourism right? from the shootings in Chicago.
Right. Yeah. but like, you know, in the hospital next to mine in the parking lot, a female nurse got followed and harassed, heckled. I can't tell you how many times I've been harassed. You know what I mean? Like verbally, this girl was getting harassed verbally and thought like, okay, whatever. And tried to ignore this person, this man, and he followed her to her car and then choked her and killed her in her car. This happened a year ago.
I was not expecting that ending there.
But yeah, so I think this is interesting. I'm going to throw this in here. This might be a hot button for some people. I don't know. But there was a moment in, I think the whole like gun thing always is like, you know, people don't know how to feel about it or they feel very strongly one way. But I've heard this from several women, and it was, you know, I'm always trying to like be open to and listen to other people's perspectives. And like in Thelma and Louise, I think this demonstrates that where, I mean, Thelma didn't know how to use a gun, and, you know, you shouldn't be walking around with a gun if you don't know how to use it, or are not practicing with it and have all of everything you need to legally own a gun. But obviously Texas is open carry, but.
Oh, they avoided Texas.
Pardon?
Oh, they did avoid Texas.
But I hear from a lot of smaller women who do choose to carry a weapon is because they are like, if I am confronted with a man who is larger than me, I don't stand a chance. Like, who's a lot larger. So that is sometimes their reason for choosing to want to have a weapon. And I just felt like in that scene, like, what were those two girls going to do to get that guy off of her?
Yeah. Cause he was a big dude.
He was a big guy and he was
like,
powerful.
Gina Davis really is like 6 feet tall. Like,
yeah,
I mean,
she was like 120 pounds.
No, I'm not. Yeah. I just mean like, and he towered over her.
Yeah.
You know, he was probably 6'3", 6'4". Like he was a big dude.
And so when you see a visual like that, and then you see somebody who's able to protect themselves and defend themselves from harm, you go, all right, I see this point. And especially like when you are a woman, I just thought it was interesting, you know, kind of piggybacking on what I've been hearing other women say, as like occasionally with politics, like, you know, gun control laws come in or like people start talking about things. I think it was an issue in Congress. There's a congresswoman from Colorado who carries. So I think that was another one of her arguments because she's pretty tiny. And I think she was also a bar owner or worked in a bar. And so it was a safety issue. But yeah, I just, this, it's a good one. Everyone should watch it.
Yeah, gray.
Yeah.
Well,
improvements.
Honestly, I think just kind of the accent thing, but I think that's just more of a thing with the acting of the time.
I wish they would have just taken, it seems like a really quick flash. Like you only get them kind of catapulting Thelma and Louise off of the cliff for like 3 seconds. And then it goes white. I wanted to see them like crash to their death, but I wish we would have gotten just a little bit more. Do you know what I mean? Do you feel kind of fast to you? I felt abrupt when it cut off.
I don't know. I think, right, because they, this is just me more creative brain thinking.
Okay.
To me, like, because it kind of ramps up, which is not how it would work anyways.
Right.
But I think the second it tilts to where it's like pointing down, it becomes real that they're crashing to the ground.
Yeah. Right?
It cuts off at the point where it looks like they're actually like flying, you know, into the sky. Like they're flying into their own world that they made.
Oh.
Like they weren't being captured or kidnapped or anything like that. But the second it like starts to go down, you're like, oh shit, they're going to crash.
That's a great point. I like that. And I'm going to stick with that. I like that.
I'm glad I could be here to help.
Well, no, I do think that makes a lot of sense. And you're right. It's like at that moment, even though their physical lives are going to end, they are the most free that they've probably ever been from anything. Yeah. Cause that whole movie is about escaping any sort of, I don't want to use the word oppression cause I almost feel like that gets overused now, but like really
toxicity.
Any toxicity, any bondage, anything that was really holding them back in life, like they are absolutely unequivocally free of in that moment.
Yeah. And they seal it with a kiss.
They do.
I read a thing. Susan Sarandon said if they'd have carried on, she thinks they'd have been a couple.
Oh my gosh. I could see that. Gina Davis got great lips. I kept looking in that movie and I was like, damn, she's got a pout.
Indeed.
Yes. Okay. So sequel and ranking. There is no sequel. I assume we're kind of deciding for ourselves that Promising Young Woman is kind of the sequel.
I mean, spiritual ish.
Yeah.
I think so. I mean, it's about, I don't know. You got to watch it.
Okay. You've given me the okay.
Are you a Thelma or a Louise?
Gosh, I think I'm a little bit of both. I've spent some time in both. I think at the end of the day, I'm at this point in my life, I'm a Louise, definitely.
You got two kids and you're into life. You're past the point of Thelma.
What about you? Are you a Thelma or a Louise?
I'm a Louise.
Crotchety Louise.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not too naive about the world, I don't think.
Yeah. Oh man, I've sure had some Thelma moments, that's for sure.
All right. Well, we should probably wrap this sucker up. What do you think?
I would say so. I would like to, as we wrap it up, just say big props to Ridley Scott as a director in the 80s and 90s, especially because he really created some strong female characters. Thelma and Louise, Ripley, even Rachel from Blade Runner. He did G.I. Jane. Like this.
I don't know if I realized he did that either.
Yeah, man. This guy made a ton of strong, badass female characters. And so, and then even look now in Raised by Wolves. Mother.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, big time.
Yeah, man, this guy's he's
flying
a woman's
snake
man.
Babies, you know?
Oh, okay. Oh. Damn it. Well, you have anything else to say about Thelma and Louise so we could get off the subject of the snake babies?
No, I do not. But if anybody listens to Raised by Wolves, you'll get that reference.
You'll know what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, it looks like coming up for the end of this month or the beginning of March, we've got a crossover episode with Guilty Pleasures and host Lou Hare. We're covering 1985's The Last Dragon. And we're timing that with Disney's release of Raya, The Last Dragon. We'll see who's the best Last Dragon. And next month in March, we've got Highlander. There Can Only Be One. And for its 35th anniversary, and since March comes in like a lion, we are going to have the tornado movie, Twister, for its 25th anniversary. Jay, what about you? Anything else coming up?
Yeah, we're going to continue to put out episodes of Flashbacks Presents Cobra Kai. We just dropped our Cobra Kai season 2 breakdown. And it's a lot of me and Larry making each other laugh and forgetting we're talking about Cobra Kai.
That's awesome.
But we always circle back. We always circle back.
You get a little Cobra Kai in there?
Oh, yeah. We get a little bit on there. And then for Flashbacks, we have an interview coming down the chute with Philip Kennedy Johnson. He is slated to be the next Superman comic writer, and he also has an Alien comic series coming out. And he's got a few other comics that are movie-based, if you will. He's got a King Kong one and Planet of the Apes and so on and so forth. And just so everybody knows, Tuesdays are our newly slotted posting days. So keep an eye out on Tuesdays for new content. Louise, let's keep going. Thank you for listening to Front Row Flashbacks, and make sure to tell your friends to check us out. Our pod is on any number of podcast apps, so look us up and please subscribe. While you're at it, if you really dig what we do, please join us as a full-time patron. Our Patreon link is in the show notes, and we would love for you to give us your money. I mean, to be a part of the team.
And be sure to look up the Front Row Network for any of our other content, like Front Row Classics, with hosts Brandon Davis and Eric Flick. Hold on a minute. We've got a guy on this podcast with the last name Flick.
He legally changed it for the show because that's the dedication we bring people at the Front Row Network.
Well, that's amazing. And just as amazing as some of our other shows, such as Guilty Pleasures, hosted by Lou Hare, and our Beyond the Mouse crew that covers all things Disney and so much more.
In short, we have something for everyone at the Front Row Network. Make sure you find the Front Row Network on Facebook and subscribe to our main feed on Spotify or whatever you use to access your podcast. We can also be found on NPR Illinois's website under Community Voices. And you can follow us on Twitter at Front Row Reviews with a Z. For the Front Row Flashbacks, this has been Ryan Lutens,
Jay Hoffman,
and Aaron McCabe.
And we will see you all in the front row.